I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, a visit to a Syrian town repeatedly hit by government aerial attacks.
I think it's random shelling. They've bombed the market and other civilian areas. The government is just taking revenge on the Syrian people.
The Libyan ambassador talks about challenges facing his nation. Political deadlock in Tunisia fuels economic frustration. And Australia asks Israel to explain the death of an alleged spy. It's all ahead. The Syrian government's bombing and shelling campaign in rebel-held areas and elsewhere in the country has caused tens of thousands to flee their homes. Correspondent Scott Bobb visited the northern town of Azaz, which has been hit repeatedly by government aerial attacks.
There are almost no unbroken windows in Azaz. Like this jewelry shop owner, residents have given up replacing the broken glass because of repeated bombings by Syrian government forces. The air attacks here began 8 months ago after rebels seized the city. More than 80% of the people in the city of 55,000 people have fled. Hundreds of residents have been killed and many more have been wounded. Two bombs last month hit near the city's 700-year-old mosque and market, killing 35, mostly women and children. Now only a few vendors in the market's covered street try to stay open. Abdullah Mahmoud says it is hard. Vegetable prices have tripled or more since the war started, and people don't have money to buy. He has thought of leaving, but stays on.
I need to do business to live. If something bad happens, it's God's will. It happens. I have no money. Where can I go?
The reason for the residents' flight is all too evident in this farming neighborhood on the outskirts of town. 3 weeks ago, 9 bombs landed here. Only one exploded. It seriously wounded Mohammed Bakri's brother-in-law, a female cousin, and 3 children. They are in a hospital in Turkey. Yet Bakri says there are no rebel forces in this area. The government maintains it is going after terrorists and is not targeting civilians.
I think it's random shelling. They've bombed the market and other civilian areas. The government is just taking revenge on the Syrian people.
Many of those who flee the attacks first go to places like this olive farm. It is outside the city and close to the Turkish border. They hope the Syrian planes will not bomb here and they will be safe. Farmer Mahmoud Ashawi left Azaz with his family of 9 after the market bombing. About 70 members of his extended family now live here in tents.
For us, it's not too bad, but we need to work. We can go to Azaz to work for a while, but when we hear the sound of jets, we run away. They don't bomb every day, but when they do, they bomb civilians.
Ashawi's family has applied for space in the ever-growing Bab al-Salama camp just this side of the Turkish border. If they get in, they will join the more than 10,000 Syrians waiting in the camp to become refugees in Turkey. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Azaz, northern Syria.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is urging the Syrian government to allow prison visits to the country to resume. The Red Cross says it has not been allowed to monitor prison conditions of detainees for nearly a year. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The head of operations for the International Committee of the Red Cross, Pierre Krechenbühl, says his organization has made no progress over the past 6 months in gaining access to places of detention in Syria. He says only 2 visits have taken place since 2011 to the central prisons in Damascus and Aleppo.
I requested concrete action from the authorities on a plan of visits to several places of detention and prisons in coming weeks, based on the commitment that they had made to our president last year and that they have reconfirmed to me on the principle of ICRC visits.
The ICRC operations chief says Syria's healthcare system has been decimated by the ongoing war.
We have really been recently informed of an incident in the north of Syria in which wounded people were said to have been arrested inside a hospital, and the medical staff in that hospital, several medical staff, were later killed because they were suspected of having been informers, which led to the arrest of the patients. Incidents like these are turning an efficient health system into a wasteland in parts of the country.
Despite the high insecurity in the country, Krechenbühl says the ICRC and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent have managed to carry out more than 100 field trips to different parts of the country last year. He says the two agencies have distributed food and hygiene parcels to 1.5 million people, many of them displaced. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of Libyans took to the streets Sunday to celebrate the second anniversary of the uprising that toppled longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Libyan National Congress leader Mohamed Magharif addressed flag-waving crowds in the North African nation's second city, Benghazi, where he urged his countrymen to join ranks and resolve our differences to build our nation. The country has been roiled by instability and violence since the ouster of Gaddafi's government in late 2011. Libyan ambassador to the U.S., Ali Ojali, spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the current state of affairs in the nation.
We are very optimistic. Of course, the challenging of building a Libyan army, which was not exist for the last 42 years, it is a challenge. The problem that we need time to do that. But in the same thing, we have this freedom fighter, or what you call them, the young revolutionaries. They are the one who is taking care of the security of the Libya and the border, and they are not a problem to us, you know, because we need them at this time. But maybe the problem, how we're going to observe them in the body of the government under different umbrellas. This is maybe their challenge. Not all of them, they want to be in the army, or they want to be in the police forces, or they want to be the security service. They are, some of them, they are civilian. They just find themselves fighting the brutal regime during the revolution. Some of them, they already left this group, fighting group, and they go back to their original jobs. But some of them, you know, many of them were unemployed by the government or by any other companies. And you know that the unemployment in Libya reached about 35% in a country of 6.5 million. Then these fighting groups, they are not a problem, as I said, in itself, but the problem, how can we absorb them? How can we train them? How can we give them a better chance? How can we create jobs for these young people? And most of them, they are young, you know. I believe the government doing a good job now, trying to observe them in different departments and trying to give some of them better education, some of them give them scholarship. Many of them, they need medical treatment, which is a great challenge. We have thousands in many neighboring countries and in Europe also, and we have some even here in the United States. But we have to build our security. Without security, we cannot build our country. And this is the priority number one.
Without achieving political stability, the Libyan economy will not be able to function. What did Libya achieve in the past 2 years to reach political stability?
I mean, we elected our General National Congress. We elected our government, transitional government. I think this is an achievement. The oil production, now it has reached the level before the revolution. We are dealing with, of course, with the security issue, which is without this, without security, we can't really achieve anything. Of course, we are approaching many friendly countries to get experience and technology from them. We have to build and we have to create an army. As you know, Gaddafi, he has no army, he has brigades to protect him and his family and his interests. This is why he's been able to kill many Libyans. For example, in Tunisia, the army, they interfere in the right time to stop Ben Ali from practicing his authority, and the same thing in Egypt, but the Libyan, it is a different case. Then I think we are doing the right thing, but as I said, we need to be patient and give the government the time. Now you see that the Libyan, they are happy to be free, and then you see the protest and the demonstration sometimes maybe every day in different big city and small cities taking place. And I think this is also okay, but it must be reasonable, you know, to give the government and the Congress time to think and to work.
Libyan ambassador to the U.S., Salih Ojali. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Tuesday on our program. As the political deadlock in Tunisia continues following the killing of opposition figure Chokri Belaid, there is growing frustration on the streets that little progress is being made in tackling the country's urgent economic problems. Henry Ridgewell reports from Tunis.
Tunisia's revolution was sparked when a fruit seller set himself on fire, an extreme protest against being fined for setting his stall in an illegal place. 2 years later, the dictator is gone, but at the market stalls in Tunis, the hardship remains. Butcher Mustafa says these days his customers spend less than a dollar a day. People can no longer buy a big piece of meat, he says. Even chicken is now out of reach for many. It takes 3 or 4 days for me to sell the meat from one sheep. Last year, Tunisia's GDP rebounded by 2.7%, but high inflation and unemployment weigh on the economy. The coffee cab factory produces thousands of kilometres of electrical cable every day. Its general manager, Hichem Alumi, who is also vice president of the Association of Employers, says economic problems have compounded.
Security is not perfect. Also social problems in the companies. Also the crisis in European Union was a big problem for us. As you know that the European Union is our first economical partner.
Over 80% of Tunisian exports go to the European Union. And with economic output shrinking in many of the EU's biggest economies at the end of 2012, the outlook remains tough. From the street to the boardroom, many Tunisians complain that politicians spend too much time debating the future instead of tackling Tunisia's urgent problems. The assassination of Chokri Belaid has plunged Tunisia deeper into political crisis, says Fadhel Abdelkadi, chairman of the Tunis Stock Exchange. I hope that the politicians will find agreement soon, he says. Once that happens, the number of people in the cabinet must be dramatically cut. And above all, the National Assembly must be given a deadline to say you have X months, 2, 3, 4 or 5 months to finish the constitution, and they must work only on that. Government spokesperson Samir Dilou says not all the criticism is fair. This government has made an effort and realized some positive results, Dilou says, but it hasn't succeeded in other challenges. But everybody is accountable for this. In all democracies, responsibility does not only rest with those who govern, but with all their partners, civil society, the opposition and the private sector. Tourism is vital to Tunisia's economy. Visitor numbers dropped after the revolution, but picked up last year. The 14th century souk in Tunis is one of the city's top attractions. Lamp seller Jamel Ben Gourba has seen the impact of the recent troubles on his business. He says the image now in Europe is that Tunisia is a terrorist country. It's made tourists avoid Tunisia. But we still have hope in the future, God willing. Many Tunisians had hoped that the political upheaval of 2011 was part of history. Now they want the politicians to bring a swift end to this latest chapter of unrest. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Tunis.
VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world. Now we want you to share your world with us. Send us your best photos, ones that capture the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. VOA judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules, go to voanews.com/iPad. Israel's Mossad spy agency is at the center of a scandal that is testing relations with Australia. Robert Berger has details from Jerusalem.
Australia is demanding information from Israel on the mysterious death of an alleged Mossad spy who held dual Australian-Israeli citizenship. The man known as Prisoner X reportedly committed suicide in an Israeli prison 2 years ago. Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr has ordered an investigation into the case, and his department will issue a report.
We have asked the Israeli government for a contribution to that report. We want to give them an opportunity to submit to us an explanation of how this tragic death came about.
According to Australian media, Prisoner X hanged himself while in solitary confinement after Israel accused him of treason. The case has caused an uproar in Australia and Israel. Questions have been asked as to how someone could commit suicide while under 24-hour surveillance at a high-security prison. Israel has maintained a blackout on many details of the case, raising criticism about Israeli censorship laws in an era when the affair was widely reported elsewhere on the Internet. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended the security establishment, saying that secrecy is a necessity. Mr. Netanyahu told his cabinet that Israel faces threats unlike any other nation, and exposing intelligence operations can seriously compromise state security. But Australia wants answers, especially after Mossad agents allegedly used Australian passports in the assassination of a senior operative of the Palestinian militant group Hamas in Dubai in 2010. Australia angrily expelled a member of the Israeli embassy in retaliation. Australian media say Prisoner X used Australian passports in Mossad operations in Iran and several Arab countries. The media reports say he contacted Australian authorities and planned to expose the use of the passports in operations, prompting his arrest by Israel. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
As we reported Friday, a new report says regions of the Middle East are quickly losing their fresh water reserves. Space technology was used by University of California, Irvine scientists and colleagues to reach that conclusion. In our continuing interview with one of the authors of the report, UCI's Jay Famoletti, we asked if anything can be done to stop the water loss.
The Middle East is an area that's always been water-stressed, and so they're quite advanced in terms of their technology and the things that they're doing already. So I'm sure they will continue to work on their research and development of agricultural and irrigation efficiencies. But one of the big things that needs to happen all over the world is that groundwater needs to be better managed. In many regions, groundwater withdrawals are not monitored. And that's, again, it's not just the Middle East. It happens here in the United States. It happens all over the world. And so it's sort of like having a free access to a bank account. And I think we're at the point now with population growth and climate change and just our demand for water, that we need to begin to bring groundwater monitoring and management under the overall water management umbrella.
This sounds like a good topic for a global forum.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's of course, a global concern, and I've been really impressed by some of the satellite data that's coming out that allows us to see the very global nature of groundwater depletion as a worldwide phenomenon.
I'd like to take a moment and just to discuss quickly how you did this study. It's high-tech science.
We used data from NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment mission, or GRACE mission. And this is a satellite that actually acts like a giant scale in the sky, weighing mass changes on Earth's surface. And on land, most of those mass changes that are being weighed by the satellites are due to water storage changes. So very literally, when a region like the Middle East uses a lot of groundwater, it loses weight, and it affects the gravity field, and those changes in the gravity field are measured by the satellite. So we use the GRACE data, and we use data from some other NASA satellites and some other international satellites, and put together a picture of what we call the water budget or the water balance of the region, just like you would do a similar thing if you were trying to balance your home budget. You'd look at the inflows and the outflows and where the money is being spent. And that's what we do with the water budget, and that's what we covered in this paper, and that's how we learned of the big losses, in particular in groundwater.
Jay Vamaletti, a professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. You can read more about the water loss in the Middle East by visiting NASA's website. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.